following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Story of my life. Alone again. But you're here, so that's a good thing. What a weird day this has been, right? Started off, well, I slept in today, which I don't usually do. I mean, I woke up at 4, and Jackson just wanted to go out. So, I just am on Jackson's schedule, whatever he wants. So I took him out at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And then usually I come in here and I start working. But today I said, you know what? I'm going to lie down again. And I did. And when I opened my eyes, it was almost 10 o'clock. So I got more sleep last night, or actually this morning, than I've gotten in days. So that's a good thing. But then, so I'm awake and I come in my studio and I start to, you know, do the research and the writing for What's News, which I try to get up and going on the Progressive Voices Network by 10 a.m. Eastern. And if I get it in by noon, I'm happy. Well, today I didn't even meet that deadline because I was sort of transfixed by the spectacle of the flying penis on my television. Yeah, for those of you watching video, well, here's the image. And sure enough, I mean, look at it. What else could it be other than a larger-than-life model of Jeff Bezos's dick, right? Because that's what the billionaires are all about. The billionaire space race is, I don't know, a big dick contest. It used to be that guys would get a Ferrari or a Lamborghini or something like that to as a dick extension. But now the billionaires are playing, playing with the big kids, and they're going for the flying machine ones. I just find it interesting. But the thing is, Jeff Bezos's blue dream, or whatever the hell it's called, thing that goes up and then comes down, that's not going into space. That's like a very high-priced amusement park ride. Really. I don't know. Now, William Shatner was on board at 90 years old. They're saying he's the oldest astronaut ever. Well, he's not an astronaut. He's an actor. And I guess if anybody deserved a seat on a flight out of the Earth's atmosphere so they can, like, look down. I mean, again, it's not, maybe I'm being a bit nitpicky here. The one that I think it was Richard Branson's group did, where they actually orbited the Earth, that's a space flight. They were overnight, weren't they? I mean, at least that. This was, what, 2 minutes up? They go weightless for a little while, and then they come back down. If you saw when after they landed, and by the way, what's really weird is they landed like in the desert. It wasn't a splashdown in the water. I don't think I've ever seen one of these capsules, land on land. So it was interesting for that purpose alone. But here, let me just share this little clip. It went on for a long time, and I think I was watching CBS, and they carried it, and it was sort of like the train wreck that I couldn't look away from. But Jeff Bezos was there to get the people out of the capsule. And, William Shatner just couldn't help himself. Here's a little bit of what he said to Bezos.
What you have given me is the most profound experience I can imagine.
He's crying.
I'm so filled with emotion about what just happened. It's extraordinary.
He might burst into song.
I hope I never recover from this. I hope that I can maintain what I feel now. I don't want to lose it.
No.
It's so
so Yeah.
So much larger than me and life.
It is.
And it hasn't got anything to do with the little green planet, the roof,
and there wasn't a gremlin on the wing, because there wasn't a wing out the window.
And the quickness and the suddenness of life and death.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And he's wiping his eyes again. I think so that beautiful. William Shatner might.
Beautiful, yes, beautiful in its way, but.
No, I mean your words.
Oh, my goodness.
Might break into song. Okay, sing it, Bill.
And I think it's going to be a long, long time. The touchdown brings me around again to find.
I'm not the man.
Not the man.
They think I am at all. Oh, no, no,
no, no,
no, no.
I'm a rocket man. Rocket man.
Rocket man.
Burning out his fuse out here.
Alone.
Alone.
Alone. All right, keep going, Bill.
And I think it's going to be a long, long time. The touchdown brings me around again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home.
Oh, no. No, no, no.
I'm a rocket man. Rocket man.
Rocket man. Sorry, that's about all I could handle of that. You know, while we're watching this country fall through the cracks, while we have idiots in D.C. saying, we can't afford that, these people are spending billions and billions of dollars to send grown men, and in some cases women, on a joyride up and then down. I guess there's a value in space travel, you know, science and all that. But remember, we also live in a time of great science denial. I'm always shocked when I hear somebody, you know, with maybe a bachelor's degree education say, well, I'm doing the research on the vaccine and I just don't see it yet. Really? So your, you know, bachelor degree education gives you more information on which to make an informed decision about whether or not to get a vaccine than the best scientists in the world. In the world. It's not, we're not only talking the U.S. here. And let me ask you, anti-vaxxers, why would any government, why would Joe Biden want to hurt you? I mean, it's not Donald Trump trying to kill off his citizens or more on death sentence here in Florida. Why would Joe Biden want to kill off the population and himself? Because he's taken the two shots and the booster. The naysayers, the flat earthers, and yes, I'm grouping them in. I thought calling somebody a flat earther was kind of a, you know, like a joke or an insult, because nobody could like believe that the earth is flat. Well, don't say nobody, because you'd be wrong. Oh, I silenced my buzzer. Thank you. There are people out there who will argue with you and tell you that the earth is indeed flat. Yeah. So, yes, yeah, somebody mentioned something about so much for a generation of STEM. These are science deniers. Why do we pay them any credence? Why do they get the slightest bit of consideration? You know, and the problem is the media. The media has to treat everybody, you know, equally, except they don't adhere to the principles of like the fairness doctrine or anything like that, to let the people who are telling you the truth. Bella Lagrisi, yes, the earth is fat. That's true. Flat, no, fat, yes. I don't know. It's more of opposite world. It's like the naysayers are taking over. There's a TV show premise for you. Just people who deny reality at every turn, because they're the ones taking over the country. It seems like there's more of them than of us, but there aren't. See, and that's the point that I'm trying to get to. Even though 73 million Americans inexplicably voted for Donald Trump in 2020, 80 million voted for Joe Biden. And like me, I'm guessing a good portion of them, we're not necessarily voting for Joe Biden. We were voting for anybody who wasn't Donald Trump. wanting it to be somebody who was more progressive. You know, I wasn't happy with the choice, but that was the choice I was given. Biden or Trump? No brainer, right? You go for Biden. You know what I was going to say next, but I won't say it. The lesser of kind of thing. But I'm not even going to go there. Because frankly, for the first 6 months or so of Joe Biden's administration, I was, and I said this on the air many times, pleasantly surprised that he embraced this progressive agenda. And, you know, it seemed to Bernie had his ear, and they were the packages, the big 10-year plan that would cost $3.5 trillion over 10 years, the Build Back Better Act. Can't we come up with a fucking better name? I'll tell you, Democrats definitely lose the branding fight. Republicans can put anything on a bumper sticker and make it stick. Democrats, not so much. And we have creative people on our side. I don't understand what the problem is. But that aside, you know, we're being overrun by the people who live in an alternate reality, right? It was like, remember Kellyanne Conway with alternate facts? This is what they buy into. It's mind-blowing. And normally, you can get past it. But now they're trying to use their influence to tell us what happened throughout history didn't really happen, right? They're trying to, in Texas, for example, where a lot of the textbooks for the public schools around the country are written, they are trying to rewrite history. And they are doing it in terms of the history of slavery and the fight, the journey of Black people throughout their time from being brought here to getting out of slavery, fighting against slavery, right? Working their way up through the civil rights era. They want to take out all mention of Martin Luther King from the history books. They want to refer to slavery as another method of immigration. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. They ban the 1619 Project, which was a wonderful series in the New York Times about slavery in this country, our history. They don't want it taught. And then they go a step further, where we don't want critical race theory taught in our high schools. It isn't. It isn't. It is a law, a section of law studies. Once you're in law school, it's not even taught in university, unless you're in law school. It's a very specialized segment, but they're talking about it as if kids in second grade are bringing home textbooks about critical race theory. Well, maybe they should, but they're not. But they should learn about Martin Luther King Jr. And if these people have their way, they won't. I'll tell you someone else that they won't learn about, and that's Fannie Lou Hamer. And you're going, who? See, this is somebody we should know about. And I'll be honest with you. When I was pitched a new book, to talk to the author of a new book about Fannie Lou Hamer, I'm like, okay, I know her name. I don't know her story. And I felt really stupid, so I immediately did some reading, and I thought, oh my God, yes, I want to do this interview. Yes, I want to talk about Fannie Lou Hamer because her story is remarkable. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you about her because our guest today is a historian and the author of the book, Until I Am Free. And it's about Fannie Lou Hamer. It's Until I Am Free. Hold on. The subtitle, Fannie Lou Hamer's Empowering Message to America. I'm going to play you, forget that video, right? The video of the Rocket Man craziness. I'm going to play for you something else. I pulled a few things. Fannie Lou Hamer, back in 1962, I want to say. Oh no, why is it? It's missing? How could that be missing? It should be in that file. All right, well, I'm going to have to locate this because maybe I have it on this computer. I pulled a couple of video clips. She spoke at the Democratic National Convention back in, again, I believe 1962. And, you know, moved, changed a lot of attitudes. Let's put it that way. Maybe this one will work. Just to give you a little bit of background, I've got a few different, let's see, will this one work? Yes. Okay. So I'm going to play for you this one. It's like 3 minutes long. It includes her testimony from, I think, you know what, this might be different. This is testimony, not the speech at the Democratic Convention. But they tell her story slightly, just to give you a little bit of background. If you, like me, were not as up on your, yes? 1960? I thought it was 62. There was no convention in 62. Okay. 1960. So let me get this. Here's the video. Here's the, David always, you know, trying to keep me from making mistakes. And he does sometimes. All right. So there was a, this is a clip from a film about, Fannie Lou Hamer. Let me share this with you. And well, it'll make sense when we hear it. So here we go. There's this.
The testimony before the Credentials Committee, the FDP had a lineup of very different people. They had Rita Schwerner, the widow of Mickey, who had been killed in Neshoba County. They had Martin Luther King. Everybody knew King.
The seating of the delegation from the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party has political and moral significance far beyond the borders of Mississippi. Are the halls of this convention.
But the highlight of the testimony was that of Fannie Lou Hamer. The sharecropper who had been evicted from her plantation had come to symbolize the Mississippi movement.
Mr. Chairman, and to the Credentials Committee, it was the 31st of August in 1962.
That 18
of us traveled 26 miles. To the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens.
Hmm.
We was met in Indianola with by policemen.
The president, Lyndon Johnson, he's not afraid of Martin Luther King's testimony. He's afraid of Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony.
Uh-huh.
And so he decides that the country should not see her testify live.
Johnson is in the White House, and he convened an impromptu press conference.
We will return to this scene in Atlantic City, but now we switch to the White House and NBC's Robert Goralski.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Wow, he interrupted her testimony.
9 months ago.
He did it knowing that they would break away, thinking he might announce who his choice of vice president was going to be. Instead, he gets up there and he announces, get this, he announces that it's 9 months to the day since Governor Connally, who was there, was shot along with President Kennedy. So he announced a 9-month anniversary. Everybody's scratching their heads.
Thank you very much.
And then he leaves.
Wow. Right? Wow.
And by that time, Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony was over.
Amazing.
However, it backfired on Johnson because it became a story that she had been taken off television and in the news that night and for days afterwards, they replayed her testimony.
I was carried to the county jail and put in the booking room. They left some of the people in the booking room and began to place us in cell.
She had Mississippi in her bones. Martin Luther King or the SNCC field secretaries, they couldn't do what Fannie Lou Hamer did. They couldn't be a sharecropper and express what it meant, right?
Right.
And that's what Fannie Lou Hamer did.
And it wasn't too long before three white men came to my cell.
Right.
One of these men was the State Highway Patrol. He said, we're going to make you wish you were dead.
Okay. So that was just a clip from this Freedom Summer, Mississippi, 1964. And I heard from a number of you while that was playing. So that testimony before the Credentials Committee of the Freedom Democratic Party was in 1962. When she spoke at the convention, the Democratic Convention, that was 1964. Regardless, the crime here today in 2021, aside from the fact that they're trying to erase our right to vote, all of us, not just, people of color, but anybody who might vote for a Democrat, they do not want us to vote. The crime, well, there are a number of crimes, but the one that I'm talking about right now is what the Republican Party in the Trump era is trying to do. Throughout the last, after the Voting Rights Act was passed in the 60s, Lyndon Johnson, the same president who cut off Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony because he didn't want the American public to hear it, so he had some bogus press conference. You just heard it. It all backfired on him because the press said, why did they cut her off? And they started playing clips of her speech so that everyone could hear everything she said. Despite Johnson's reluctance to go along with civil rights legislation, he did. You know, maybe he was against it at the beginning, but he kind of moved mountains to get it done. Johnson is, one of these days, I'll have to get someone on to talk about Johnson because he's a fascinating subject. You know, he's vilified, obviously, because the Vietnam War escalated so much under him. And if not for the Vietnam War, he'd probably go down as one of the best, most progressive presidents out there because he is the one who got the Great Society stuff passed. He got us voting rights. So, you know, he was a monumental figure in more ways than one. But again, the Vietnam War overshadows everything else. But today's Republican Party wants nothing of it. So in the years following the adoption of the Voting Rights Act, you know, Congress would have to reauthorize it every so many years. I think it was like every 10 years, but don't hold me to that because my knowledge of history is not the best. But throughout, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, it would pass the Senate almost unanimously. It was like 98-2 or 99-1 or, you know, unanimous. There was never the thing about the Republican Party that they were trying on the surface publicly to get you not to vote. We do know that from the 80s on, at least, that was their strategy, right? I mean, you've heard the clip a million times, the good government clip about, what's his name? Paul Weyrich, this one.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Yeah, so that's what, you know, that was 1980. So obviously this has been their long game strategy for a long time, but they didn't come out and say the quiet part out loud. What they've learned from Donald Trump is that nothing matters. Nothing matters. It doesn't matter if you lose. All you have to do is with a straight face, go before a crowd of people and the cameras and look directly into the camera and say, we won. We won. Donald Trump continues to this day to say, we won in 2020 by a landslide.
Bullshit.
Obviously bullshit. But he says it anyway. And that somehow gave permission to all his sycophantic followers out there to do the same thing. So I'm here in Florida. We had a backbencher of a congressman from the Panhandle area named Ron DeSantis. 4 years ago, nobody ever heard of this guy, but he sucked up to Trump. So Trump, you know, all you have to do to get Trump's endorsement is flatter him. And he did. So Trump endorsed him. He rode the Trump train to the Florida governor's office. This man, he gets off on being a mini him. He wants to be Trump so badly that he did the same shit. First of all, during the campaign, he dressed his infant child in Trump gear. This is the same idiot who, when Florida is leading the nation in coronavirus, COVID infections and hospitalizations and deaths.
We're number one, damn it!
That guy, you know, he has a law against vaccine mandates, a law against mask mandates in schools where people, where kids are getting infected at record rates and dying. Children dying of COVID because they're told you're not allowed to wear a mask in school. You can't require the kids wear a mask in school. And so now there were school districts and counties defying his ridiculous mandates or law against mandates that they said, well, screw you. It's more important we protect our kids and our teachers and our people than listen to your unscientific bullshit. So then death sentence says, okay, well then I'm going to make you pay. So the upshot of this is yesterday, the Florida Department of Health of all entities, files a fine against Leon County, Florida. Leon County is where Tallahassee is. Florida State University, the Florida capital is Tallahassee. That's Leon County. Well, Leon County had a vaccine mandate following the president's rule that all government offices and private companies with more than 100 employees, if I remember correctly, must be vaccinated or show proof of vaccines or negative test, weekly, I think it is, as a condition of employment. So DeSantis said he was going to do this, and yesterday he did. They hit Leon County with a $3.57 million fine. $3.5 million for Leon County, Florida, for disobeying Ron death sentences, death sentence? It's astounding. So here's how that happens. There are 714 government employees in Leon County. They were told a condition of your employment is you must be vaccinated. So 714 employees were affected. 14 refused. 14, they were fired. The Florida government, the health department, like they've got the authority, levied this $3.57 million fine against Leon County, Florida. $5,000 for each of the 714 government employees that they require to get vaccinated. Are you fucking kidding me? Leon County, Florida can't afford $3.5 million for this, nor should they. That is bullshit.
Bullshit.
It's just, it's unconscionable. And so the state is kind of split. Now, I want to know from Republicans, how can they defend this behavior? Children are getting sick. Children are dying. One thing we do know is that people can, you know, yes, there are some breakthrough cases of COVID from people who've been vaccinated do get it, but what they get is a much milder case, and they don't wind up dying for the most part. Most of them don't even wind up in the hospital. They feel shitty for a few days. Well, I'll tell you what, when I got the second Moderna shot and when I got the booster, because, you know, I'm a lung cancer survivor, so yes, I got the booster, I felt lousy for about a day and a half. I'll take it. I'd go through it again and again and again if it would prevent me from getting COVID. I see how people are suffering. But again, we have reality deniers in this country, the same people who are saying you can't, you know, demand that that your children are vaccinated before they go back to school, are here in Florida, are also saying, you know what, even if your kid is exposed to another child with COVID, we don't have to inform you. We don't have to tell the parents. There is no quarantine requirement. All I want to say is, why does the governor of Florida want to kill the people of Florida? You know, if there's any justice, divine justice, maybe it'll be the people who actually vote for that idiot who get sick. I'm just astounded. So this opposite world thing is going on. The same way they're telling you, don't believe the facts, believe the crazies. They're in Texas rewriting the textbooks again to take away references to Martin Luther King, to say that slavery was another form of immigration. And we wonder, and I wondered, why more of us don't know how amazing Fannie Lou Hamer was. Well, now we know. We know because many of us knew. I don't want to put everybody in the boat that I'm in. But there's this new book that is just out. In fact, it was released this week or last week, just I think a day after Fannie Lou Hamer's birthday. And it's called Until I Am Free. And it is by Keisha N. Blaine, and she's our guest. She joins us right now. Keisha, I got to get our shot set up because I really kind of screwed this up and I didn't do it. But you know what? I'm going to bring you in so we can talk while I get our shot together. I've just been on a rant this morning about opposite world, how people for some reason believe the what, like the least educated, no credentialed, nonsense purveyors, that, you know, instead of the authorities, the scientists, the people who know what's going on. So with that in mind, Keisha Blaine, thank you so much for joining us today. It's so nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. So let me ask, what made you decide to write this book? And while you're answering, I will get our shot up here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I first learned about Fannie Lou Hamer more than a decade ago. I was taking a course as an undergrad. It was actually my last year of college. And I think ever since I learned about Hamer, I have just been inspired by her life story, deeply moved by her words. And I think over the last several years, with the, you know, the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, which of course has forced us all to talk more about state-sanctioned violence, you know, anti-Black racism, you know, I think in this particular context, I returned to Hamer and started to think through how her words and her deeds could in fact provide a blueprint for all of us who are seeking justice, all of us who are committed to improving the lives of others. And so I wanted to write a book that would in effect explain Hamer's life story, her legacy, but more so be an educational tool for anyone willing to listen to Hamer, anyone willing to learn.
You know, I'm so glad you did. Again, I feel really stupid, but I admit I'm not, you know, the biggest history buff. But it shouldn't be a history buff only who knows about Fannie Lou Hamer. Yes. I'm amazed that you didn't know about her until, you know, college. Yes. She should be taught in schools along with the fight, the women's fight for the vote, Voting Rights Act, all of that. And we're severely lacking in that area in terms of what our kids are taught. And we seem to be moving in the wrong direction.
Unfortunately, that is certainly the case. And I have been teaching courses on the civil rights movement for several years. I mean, I think since 2014, I've been offering a course on the civil rights movement. And I will tell you that probably only within the last 2 years, you know, do I recall a student saying, oh, I've heard of Fannie Lou Hamer. Most of the students who come into my classroom have never heard of her at all. And even those who say, oh, I've heard of her, don't actually know much about her. They might have heard her name. They might have seen, you know, a meme or some sort of quote circulating. They might have heard things like, you know, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, which is
yes,
a well-known phrase.
Right.
That we often use, right? That comes
yes.
from Fannie Lou Hamer. So there's a way in which she's certainly present in the public discourse, even when she's invisible, because we're using her words often, but not even attributing those words to her specifically.
So tell us a little bit about her, because she got started as an activist later in life. It wasn't like, you know, she was out of the gate, like fighting. What got her involved? Was it that she couldn't register to vote, or what happened when she tried to register?
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, was born into a sharecropping family. And as I explained in the book, she was the youngest of 20 children. you know, her life was really consumed with sharecropping. And you know, this is, for those who might not be familiar, you know, a system of exploitation that ultimately replaced slavery. So in the aftermath of the Civil War, white landowners introduced this system, which ultimately kept Black people, particularly in the South, in a system of dependency and debt. And so Fannie Lou Hamer worked as a sharecropper, and it was not until August 1962 that she attended a local meeting at a church that was organized by activists in the Student Nonviolence Coordinating Committee. And you're absolutely right. She was 44 years old, which made a huge difference because many of the activists who were present that night, those who were involved in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, were college age. You know, they were much younger. And so Hamer came to the movement a bit later in life. But from the moment that she learned in that meeting about her constitutional right to vote as a citizen of the United States, she just thrust all of her time and effort into it, and her life was never the same.
I played a clip before you came on earlier on the program from 1962. It was her testimony before the Credentials Committee at the Freedom Democratic Party meeting. Can you explain mm-hmm. what that, because I'm confused, because there was that in 1962, and then there was her address to the Democratic National Convention, I believe in 1964. But it was in the 1962 testimony that President Johnson had the plug pulled, basically, and said, cut her off, I don't want this going on television. And he did a bogus press conference about nothing mm-hmm. that then backfired. Can you tell what those two events were and set me straight? Because I know I got something wrong.
Yeah. So it's actually one event.
It was.
Which is August 1964. Right. Oh. And so she joined the movement in August 1962. And then in August 64, she traveled from Mississippi to Atlantic City to attend the Democratic National Convention. And that's when she gave the testimony before the Credentials Committee.
Oh, okay.
So what you're talking about is what I think most anyone who knows anything about Fannie Lou Hamer probably knows her through the context of that speech. That speech ultimately catapulted her career, her political career, because many people heard her testimony and they were deeply moved. And you're absolutely right. The testimony was so powerful that it terrified President Lyndon B. Johnson. He tried to divert attention away from Fannie Lou Hamer. She was talking about state-sanctioned violence, right, which I referred to earlier. She was talking about voter suppression. She was talking about what she had endured as a Black woman living in Mississippi and what other Black people were encountering when they were attempting to exercise the right to vote. And she was calling attention to the way that the state Democratic Party excluded Black participation. Here she was at the DNC, pointing out that the party that was supposedly representing the state did not even consider the voices and the interests of an estimated 450,000 Black residents in the state of Mississippi. Unbelievable. But that is the circumstances when we think about the 1960s. And Fannie Lou Hamer blew the lid open and terrified a lot of people, but she made such a huge difference.
So what, how she spent, the subsequent years, obviously being involved, fighting for civil rights. Mm-hmm. She ran for office, right? She didn't win.
Mm-hmm. No, and she ran a total of three times, was not successful. But she always said that even though she knew that it would be difficult to win, particularly just given the context, right? We're talking about voter suppression. And so if people are blocking African-Americans from even casting a ballot, then you know that it's not going to be easy to actually, have enough people vote for you to elect you into office. So she was aware that it was ultimately a challenge, but she did it to send a message. She did it to empower others so that they would see the possibilities. And she was deeply committed, as I explained in the book, deeply committed to women's empowerment. She was involved in a National Women's Political Caucus, which she helped establish in 1971. So she was so committed to women serving in office, running for office. All of that was important to her. And she demonstrated that through her own actions, through running for office several times.
In the testimony, and we only heard parts of it, there was a wraparound news segment that explained what was going on. So I played it because a lot of people, sadly, are in the dark about Fannie Lou Hamer. So, but she said something about when she got home from trying to register to vote, there were men there who beat her. She was subject to a lot of violence, a lot of what happened there?
Wow, she was subjected to a lot of violence, as you point out. And I'll talk about that beating, which took place in 63 in Winona, Mississippi. But if you take several, if you sort of rewind several years before 1961, this is before Hamer joins the civil rights movement. Hamer was the victim of a forced sterilization. And just to give context of what happened, it's just a tragic story.
Oh my God.
Hamer was hospitalized because she had a small uterine tumor. It was a non-cancerous tumor. The white doctor who performed the procedure, unbeknownst to Hamer, decided to remove her uterus.
Oh my God.
And to add insult to injury, didn't even tell Hamer after the procedure. She learned about it shockingly through gossip, because the doctor was related to someone, to the wife actually, of the plantation owner. And oh, so through the Whisper Network, she learns about this act of violence took place. And she confronted the doctor, who did not respond, did not provide an explanation. Now, of course, we understand the context of Mississippi. What happened to Hamer happened to many Black women, happened to many impoverished women. Doctors, for a range of reasons, certainly because they, determined in their mind who was fit to have children or unfit to have children, but also there were financial incentives too. And Hamer decided that she would talk about it, not immediately. She certainly went through the pain and trauma of the experience. It took her some time. But when she became a civil rights activist, one of the things that she confronted was this forced sterilization. So that was one pivotal moment in her life. And the second is the beating that you are referencing in 1963, where she's traveling with a group of activists. You know, they had come from a voter registration workshop, heading back home. And Hamer was at a rest stop. You know, they all stopped. You know, some people, you know, had to use the bathroom, grab a bite to eat.
Right.
And officers grabbed them. You know, Hamer came off of the bus. An officer started kicking her. Police officers. Absolutely.
Oh, my.
In fact, that's one of the things I talk about in the book. I talk about the police violence and the intimidation, you know, that Hamer experienced. And Hamer was taken to a Winona prison cell. And there, she was beaten. And in fact, officers instructed prisoners to beat her. And so this became just such a traumatic experience for Hamer. She would later admit, initially she didn't share, but she would later share that it was also a sexual assault. An array of challenges in that particular context. What I think is so powerful about her story is how she managed to keep going, right? Because for so many people, after having that kind of experience, one might say, you know, enough is enough. If I'm going to be beaten this way simply to try to register to vote and to encourage people to exercise their rights as citizens, then I might as well, right, not be bothered, because it's too much. For Hamer, she decided that she would somehow turn that pain into political action yet again. And so it became a focal point. She would talk about the beating to shed the light on what Black people were enduring, in the struggle for Black political rights.
Boy, that's astounding. And hearing that, as I was doing research, preparing for this interview, I noticed that a lot of right-wing, I hate to call them pro-life, anti-choice groups are embrace her and say Fannie Lou Hamer was against abortion. Well, maybe because of what they did to her. Yeah,
absolutely. In fact, as I explained in the book, she so wanted to have children, right? She wanted to have children. Had miscarriages. You know, so that experience in 61 was so traumatic for her, and I think when it came to the issue of abortion and even birth control, right? I mean, and to be clear, you know, her perspectives went contradicted. It went against what many of the women she collaborated with. I mean, in the women's liberation movement, certainly there was a strong support, for birth control. You know, certainly recognizing the importance of women's choice when it comes to the matter of abortion. Hamer struggled with that. I mean, she just could not accept either. And it comes out of that painful experience in 61 with that forced sterilization. She would constantly reference it. You know, she would say, look what I went through, because it took away from her the ability to have children. And so she really could not go along with supporting,
abortion rights.
Yeah, right. Abortion rights. Yeah, right. So it's just, so as you say, we have to contextualize it and understand what she experienced.
Right. But there's no way she'd be aligned with those people who are trying to, appropriate her name today. It's a different world. Now, I think she probably would be aligned with Black Lives Matter, because what they're protesting is exactly what was done to her.
Exactly. And in fact, that's why I started, one of my chapter, well, two, one chapter I start with Sandra Bland. And of course, crucial to understanding the state, say her name movement to call attention to state sanctioned violence, particularly through the experiences of Black women and girls. And also in another chapter, I talk about Breonna Taylor. Right. And I talk about the political activism that followed just last summer.
Yeah.
And I think those were important to emphasize, because we can see the direct connections to Fannie Lou Hamer. You know, she was very vocal about state sanctioned violence. She was very vocal about the kinds of indignities that she endured as a Black woman, as a disabled Black woman, as a working poor Black woman living in the South. I mean, she was truly, as I explained in the book, a foremother of intersectionality, right? We talk about intersectionality today through, the writings of Kimberly Crenshaw, but truly we can see how Hamer emphasized how it's important to think about how all of these experiences are connected, that there are interlocking systems of oppression, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to talk about racism, but you also have to talk about classism and sexism and so on. And Hamer pointed that out in her life. Story, I think, reveals the importance of thinking in intersectional terms.
So she didn't have children, but obviously she left people in her wake. I mean, there were people who she was aligned with. Who are her political, descendants?
Well, and to clarify, she ended up adopting, and she did. And,
I'm an adoptive mother too, so I love that.
Right, yes. Right. And I think that was just such a great experience for her, because, she just showered, she just showered these young girls with so much love. And so I think fundamentally she was able, I think, to still mother in that sense, and also to mother, a larger community. I think, for example, I talk about in the book how she established Freedom Farm in the late 1960s, just to provide, a means to tackle poverty and hunger in the community. You know, there's a way in which she just gave up, of herself. I mean, anyone who met her, who encountered her, would talk about her hospitality. So she just extended her love in various ways. And so when you think about her legacies, there's so many people that I think of. One person that comes to mind is Stacey Abrams. Mm. And I think we can understand that in the context of the struggle, right? For voting rights still in the contemporary context, Stacey Abrams has been such a crucial voice in challenging voter suppression, not only in Georgia, but really on a national level. And I see so much of that fight, in Hamer's story. I see Stacey Abrams, certainly Latosha Brown, Amy, Allison from, the organization She the People, so many remarkable Black women who are specifically addressing voter suppression in the contemporary context. And then also, we've been talking about Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. So I think about, someone like Appal Temeti, one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, and who I talk about in the book, you know, as speaking before the United Nations in 2016, and the resonances, you know, to the connections to Hamer speaking in the 60s and 70s about the importance of thinking about, you know, the global dimensions of the struggle for liberation. So there are so many that we can focus on.
We're speaking with Keisha Blaine. She's the author of the new book, Until I Am Free. Another statement, words taken from one of her speeches or presentations. I found there's a surprisingly number of pieces of her on YouTube, if you look. So I pulled one. This runs about a minute, but I just love listening to her. So let me play this and then get your thoughts on it afterwards. Here's Fannie Lou Hamer. This is from same passage, whatever
I'm
that is.
I'm thinking about in terms of a better and a greater world for all people. And we can't do that by me in one corner doing what I can do to hurt you and you in the other corner doing the same thing against me. I'm not concerned about just representing black people, because we have poor white that's in the same category with the poor Negro. Well, I want to see a change for the people. And if we can get a good white man, all right, we'll put him in office. But I don't want it all black, and I don't want it all white. I've never thought in terms of a violent, of all the things that have been gained by people fighting and going through blood for it. They don't have anything, you know. This, to me, it doesn't make sense. If I hate you because you hate me, I'm no better than you are. And all we want to do is to make these people understand that we are human beings and we can work together in this country. And to have a democracy, that's what we're going to have to do.
Wow. I mean, you think about what's going on today and you listen to those very prophetic words. I mean, she saw it coming. She was trying to say, we don't want to go down that road. And that's exactly where we are. It's astounding. I mean, my mind is blown daily seeing this opposite world that we're living in. We're seeing the science deniers, the flat earthers, get a hold on society. It's just frightening. We need straight talkers like her. But it's also interesting that today I'm realizing we're really not taught about Fannie Lou Hamer. And I wonder how many others like her are basically lost to the history because the people who are writing the books didn't see fit to include them.
There are so many others. In fact, I'm writing a book as we speak. I'm writing a book on how Black women have led the struggle for human rights from 1865 to the present. And not surprisingly, many of the women, if not most, who I'm writing about, many people have not heard of these women. Because as you say, It's so important to have people writing about these histories, because that's partly why I certainly advocate diverse voices in telling the history, you know, and I emphasize how we have to be thinking about that as educators. You know, what do we assign? You know, whose voices are included, whose voices are excluded? It matters. It matters. And we're seeing that play out. You know, as you pointed out earlier, we're seeing that play out in the decisions people are making, how they're talking about figures, you know, clearly a lack of knowledge. And so I certainly want to play a part as an educator in ensuring that voices like Fannie Lou Hamer's, you know, are elevated and celebrated too.
Right. You know, she died in 1977. That's the year I graduated high school. This is not ancient history. I know I'm old, but this is not ancient history. This is recent history, and we need to do a better job of passing along these stories. It seems like, you know, in ancient times, they had a better handle on it. They'd have the scribes who would write down the stories and pass them down. We just, I don't know, we're controlled by powers that say, well, this is appropriate for our schools. What's going on in Texas with the textbooks right now is particularly troubling. Do you know if there's a major pushback on that? Or, my disappointment in the Democrats these days is to the point where I want something done about everything now. And it seems like too many important things are falling through the cracks because there are also these huge issues that are not being taken care of. The textbooks in Texas is a big deal. I'm not hearing it talked about enough. Are we doing enough to make sure that mm-hmm. accurate history is passed down? I mean, look at what they did to the 1619 Project, and now it's all about critical race theory, which, as you know, mm-hmm. is not being taught in school. So this again, this bad information is coming in, trying to squash the real information that we should be teaching our kids about.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I think it's so important for educators, you know, to be informed. You know, as you pointed out, you for example, the case in Texas, I certainly know that lots of historians are pushing back, you know, and I know this for some people, it may be viewed as a small response, but I don't think it's a small response. I think it matters, you know, when people come together and say, OK, we're not going to just sit down and let this slide. We're going to call this out. And quite frankly, yes, there's still a lot that needs to be changed. But I certainly know that the textbooks that you know are being used in Texas today are a bit different than the textbooks that were used, you know, in the 30s, for example.
Right.
And so we have to continually keep pushing forward. And I think educators have a role to play. I would also say parents have a role to play.
Definitely.
You know, every one of us have a role to play.
You know, I'm pretty pessimistic about things right now. As you're a historian, you've studied this, you teach this. I wouldn't talk about what you do, but you've written a number of books. You're an associate professor of history at University of Pittsburgh. You're the president of the African American Intellectual History Society. So this must weigh very heavily on you. And I'm glad you're writing about it and getting it out there. You know, I think we've come to a point in history where everything's in a tinderbox ready to explode. Black Lives Matter and the protests of last summer had to happen. The question is, where do we go from here? How do we, you know, as a white woman in America who didn't learn enough of these stories growing up, frankly, and I'm doing my best to, you know, learn about people like Fannie Mae Hamer, Fannie Lou Hamer. Where do we go from here? Obviously, teach our kids, spread these stories, share your book, and try to vote the flat earthers out of office and get people who are willing to embrace the truth in there. But is that enough? I mean, it seems like we're always on defense, pushing back against the crazy that's coming at us.
Well, we have to keep fighting. I mean, I think one of the benefits of being a historian is that I've spent a lot of time paying attention to patterns, certainly, you know, paying attention to developments over time. And so I, in a way, I knew that certain things would happen after the uprisings. Why? Because history has taught us that every time there is sort of mass political mobilization in order to effect meaningful change, you will have backlash. And so the question was always for me, okay, what form will that backlash take? Well, now we know the answer, you know, clearly through voter suppression tactics, also through, you know, January 6th. I mean, so all of these developments in a way were inevitable because of what took place in the spring and the summer. But I also think what's useful about turning to history is recognizing that there are moments of victory, too. And oftentimes they come after a long, long period of struggle where it seems like you're not actually making progress, and then you do make progress. And so that's, you know, part of the story of hope. But also to go back to Fannie Lou Hamer and even the title of the book, you know, I chose a title which comes directly from one of her speeches, whether you are black or white, you know, you are not free until I am free.
There you go.
And I think that's such a powerful message. It's for us to recognize that we're all connected. Despite our differences, we are all part of the American polity. And that means that we all have to collectively work together to make this place better for all of us, so that we can all exist, certainly, but so that we can all thrive, which is the most important part. So I hope people find inspiration in the story and that it compels them to continue the fight and not give up.
Without a doubt. The book is called Until I Am Free. Keisha Blaine, thank you so much. This is fascinating. The book is great reading. I encourage everyone to check it out and learn the stories and teach your kids the stories. You can't depend on the powers that be to do it because they're not always in the right place. We need to, you know, to tell the truth. Keisha, thank you so much. This was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. And there you go. Keisha Blaine, the book, once again, Until I Am Free. Go check it out. All right. Tomorrow's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. Oh boy, do we have a lot to talk about. So we will do that. And, yeah, I will leave you with the news because we can. Yeah. Or to Audible. Yes. Joy Williams said Audible. Build back better. Thank you, Gloria. Thank you. I got other stuff to talk about. We'll save it for tomorrow. I feel stupid. I feel really stupid in that I didn't know. I knew the name, right? Fannie Lou Hamer. I've heard her name. I didn't know her story. Now, you guys know Amy Simon. Amy Simon, my friend who, dear old friend, who these days, she's the writer and performer and the person behind this one-woman show she wrote called She's History. And it's all about women throughout history. And, you know, I emailed her first thing this morning to tell her that I was speaking with Keisha Blaine today about Fannie Lou Hamer because I knew Amy would be, you know, thrilled about it. And then I said, and on Monday, I'm interviewing Anita Hill. And sure enough, she called today. She's like, oh my God, I know I've owed you a phone call forever, but wow. So she's excited. She's one of the people who's telling the stories of the women that we didn't necessarily know. People like Amy who are passing down these stories are so important. Just like those scribes in ancient times, the rabbis in ancient times who wrote down the stories that became the Old Testament. I don't even know if that's how it happened because I didn't pay attention those days in school. But that's how it happened. The stories were passed down generation to generation. And I think we've gotten lazy. We need to share those stories of history, those true stories of what really happened to make sure they don't happen again. You know, I posted for yesterday's show on the blog, the song History Repeating, which I would have opened the show with yesterday. We had Harvey J.K. on. If I was allowed to play music on the program and not get copyright violated, but it's by a band called the Propeller Heads featuring Shirley Bassey. And that's the feeling I get. So if history repeats, I don't even want to think about what's coming, but know that it goes in cycles. All right. I'm talking myself into circles. I'm just going to leave you with the news. I'm going to shut up now and I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for bearing with me, everyone. Go do something good for other people. And for yourself. All right. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
A figurative Band-Aid has been applied to a gaping, hemorrhaging wound. It'll last about 2 months. Then it could all implode. We are not in a good place right now, and Congress is on recess. Really. The House came back from recess for one day on Tuesday to pass the bill raising the debt ceiling temporarily. That now goes to President Biden for his signature. But the question begs, why is Congress on recess? This is unquestionably crunch time, with both the debt ceiling and a government shutdown looming, plus the ridiculous reality that two renegade conservative senators with D's next to their names are threatening not only the Democrats' majority in Congress, but the White House and the future of our democracy itself. And that's not hyperbole. Politico's playbook this morning finally told us where Manchinima is in their demands, and they're not working together. In fact, their demands, if both acted on, would basically render the entire Build Back Better agenda worthless. Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Monday night alerted her members that the whole plan would have to be pared down to get the two obstructionists on board. But the Progressive Caucus says not so fast. Pramila Jayapal, is chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
I'm not drawing any red lines until I see what the final package is, because it's really not about the number. It's about what programs are in there. You could have a number that was much higher, but it cuts out several of the key programs. We would not be for that. You could have a number that's slightly lower than that, but it keeps all of our programs. It just funds them for a shorter period of time. We could live with that. So that's what we're waiting for. For us, the most important thing for the Progressive Caucus is we identified five key priorities for the caucus. It includes the care economy, includes housing, includes immigration, includes health care, particularly expanding Medicare, and it includes climate change. Those five priorities, and we have some specificity, should all be contained in whatever the final bill is. And we would rather trim back the number of years if we have to come down slightly than cut a program.
Did you catch that part? The progressives are suggesting passing shorter-term safety net expansions instead of getting rid of entire sections of the legislation. I like that idea. Meanwhile, the global economy is in trouble. As much as the obstructionist right would have you place the blame on Biden, he's not the cause of this problem. Computer chip shortages, port congestion, a lack of truck drivers. The world's supply chains are under extreme stress, and it's causing prices to go up for consumers and slowing the global economic recovery. Experts warn that the supply chain disruptions will get worse before they get better. Moody's reporting this week, quote, "As the global economic recovery continues to gather steam, what is increasingly apparent is how it will be stymied by supply chain disruptions that are now showing up at every corner. Border controls and mobility restrictions, unavailability of a global vaccine pass, and pent-up demand from being stuck at home have combined for a perfect storm where global production will be hampered because deliveries are not made in time, costs and prices will rise, and GDP growth worldwide will not be as robust as a result." The Moody's report warned that the weakest link may be the shortage of truck drivers, an issue that has led to congestion at ports and caused gas stations in the UK to go dry. While trying to make things better, President Biden on Wednesday announcing that the Port of Los Angeles will begin operating around the clock as they try to relieve the backlogs in the global supply chain. Baby steps. Also, the United States will lift border restrictions on travel from Canada and Mexico for fully vaccinated people beginning in November. Unvaccinated travelers will still be prevented from crossing the borders. But truckers and students, who were never banned, by the way, will also have to start showing proof of vaccination beginning in January. Well, Texas-based Southwest and American Airlines both said they will continue to mandate that employees get vaccinated against COVID-19, despite Governor Greg Abbott's new executive order banning such requirements. Southwest released a statement that read, "Federal action supersedes any state mandate or law." Well, someone might want to come down here to Florida to tell our governor, Ron DeSantis. He's now made good on his threat to fine local governments that require employees to be vaccinated. He's now given Leon County, that's where Tallahassee is, until November 5th to pay a $3.5 million penalty. That's because Leon County requires vaccines as a condition of employment. So 714 employees had to get the shots. 14 were fired because they refused. So DeSantis fined the county $5,000 per employee. 5,000 times 714 comes out to $3,570,000. Ridiculous. A record 4.3 million people quit their jobs across the country in August, beating the previous high of 4 million set in April. This figure, which amounts to 2.9% of the U.S. workforce, reflected the changing attitudes about work and home life among Americans since the pandemic changed everything last year. Many workers have expressed unwillingness to put up with low wages and difficult hours, so they're seeking new opportunities. Many businesses have had to raise wages to avoid being short-staffed, giving workers leverage to seek positions with better pay and conditions. Well, they should. And finally, William Shatner is Rocket Man.
Rocket Man. Burning out his fuse out here, alone. I think it's gonna be a long, long time.
till touchdown bring me round again and find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no, no. I'm a rocket man.
The 90-year-old Star Trek Captain Kirk blasted off in what looked like a giant penis into space, where he flew around weightless for a couple of minutes and then came back to Earth. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is completely listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.